Nagarjuna, what are you talking about? Welcome back. This is Buddhist Books Podcast, episode 319. Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika, part one, in which we'll begin reading Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika. Took a little bit of practice to be able to say that. I'm probably not saying it correctly.
So, I'm pretty sure that every time I said that in today's recording, I said it wrong. So, it's the first episode, so moving forward, hopefully we'll get it right. I should have said Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika, not Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika, as I added an extra ka in there. So, sorry about that.
But it's something close to the fundamental wisdom of the middle way. That's how it's translated in this Garfield Oxford translation. For those who are new, I would invite you to check out this introduction to Buddhist Books Podcast. It was recorded a couple years ago, so it's pretty thorough. Most of what I went over in that introduction is still true. The only things that have been added are that 2 times out of every 10, so whenever the episode number ends with a 2 or ends with an 8, there's this clock up here. When it ends with a 2 or ends with an 8, then we read Zen or Chan. The green book is Japanese Zen. The not green book by the 2 is Chinese Chan from the 6th century. Anyway, the Dharma wheels are all Tipitaka, pre-sectarian early Buddhism. That's our main focus, but it was 6 out of 10 Tipitaka. Now it's 5 out of 10 because we're adding this. We've been at it for about 4 years now. And initially, I was thinking we would read all of the Tipitaka and then get into the Mahayana. And it's clear after 4 years we're only, you know, on the 5th book. And so it's going to take a very long time. And so I thought it was about time to start reading some Nagarjuna. He came about 600 years after Lord Buddha. So it was kind of a different time and place and a different conversation. And I don't know a whole lot about it. I only skimmed it very briefly in preparation to begin the Buddhist Books podcast project 4 years ago. So my limited understanding is that after, everything that we're reading normally happened, Lord Buddha passed away. I believe it was Ananda who took over the leadership role. And then someone took over from him. I think there's a whole lineage that led up to, then there was the first council, the second council, and then the third council under King Ashoka. And then Buddhism became very well established in India. And then fast forward another 300 years or so, and there were these great debates, apparently, between different philosophies, different philosophical schools, what we today term Hindu and Buddhist schools, of which there were apparently 18. I had heard 14, but then I heard 18. I'm not entirely sure. So, you know, they were debating about, rather than, you know, where normally when a Buddhist monk would speak to someone who's interested and they would speak the Dharma, they would be speaking about specific things, liberation and that kind of thing. But these debates would be like, what is the nature of the universe? What is the nature of reality? What is the, and these things that, perhaps Lord Buddha touches on some of those things more in the teachings basket. For the past 4 years, we've been reading the rules basket, which I know is a bit of a silly thing to do, but that's what we've been doing. We'll get to the teachings later. But anyway, apparently, you know, these 18 schools all had different answers, and so it was kind of like looking a little bit dire for Buddhism, because if, you know, the local rulers, kings, and so on, don't like them, then they will, you know, maybe cease to exist. And so then apparently, the story goes, along came Nagarjuna and revolutionized everything the Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika. So this was around 150 Common Era. And then he laid a layer on top of the foundation at the early period of Mahayana, and then that Mahayana layer was part of the foundation for Vajrayana and Zen and some of these familiar forms of Buddhism later on. So it's interesting getting to know these layers and doing these deep dives into these teachings. And apparently there's some commentary, which is unfortunate, because one aspect of this whole project is to read the original teachings and try to set aside what people in the 21st century or the 20th century or the 19th or 18th century, frankly, had to say about it, their commentary, or, well, let me explain this to a Western quote-unquote audience. I'm oversaturated with that, and so I will skim through the commentary, if we have to. There's an introduction. The full title is The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika, Translation and Commentary by J.L. Garfield. All right. I dedicate this as Garfield. I don't know. When is he writing? He's writing in 1955. 1955! Back to the Future fans, anybody? I dedicate this work with profound gratitude and respect to the most venerable Professor Samdong Rinpoche, scholar, educator, statesman, public servant, and shining exemplar of monastic life. Okay. So he had a Tibetan guide, teacher, friend. All right. This is a translation of the Tibetan text of the Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika. It is perhaps an odd idea to translate a Tibetan translation of a Sanskrit text and to retranslate a text of which there are four extant English versions. My reason for doing so are these. First, I am not satisfied with any of the other English versions. Every translation, this one included, of any text embodies an interpretation, and my interpretation differs in various respects from those of my predecessors in this endeavor. This is to be expected. As Tuck, 1990? Okay, so how could this have been translated in 1955 if he's talking about things going on in 1990? Oh, he was born in 1955. Okay, all right. So Garfield, the translator, with respect, I hope that if you're watching, Jay, thank you for this translation, and I will be using the cartoon cat to refer to you, and I hope that that's okay. I'm sure that kids probably born in 1955. No, you were an adult before Garfield was a thing, so probably no kids teased you about that. If anything, they teased you about the president Garfield. Okay, I will just get back into it. So this is a little more recent than I realized. Okay, fair enough. As Tuck, 1990, has correctly observed, a previous translator, presumably, Nagarjuna, like any philosopher from a distant cultural context, is always read against an interpretive backdrop provided by the philosophical presuppositions of the interpreter, and by previous readings of Nagarjuna. So I claim no special privileged position vis-a-vis Strang, 1967, Inada, 1970, Sprung, 1979, or Kalupahana, 1986. So those are apparently the previous translations of Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika. Those who have read one of those, and feel free to comment below and let me know what you thought of those. Okay. Only a different position, one that I hope will prove useful in bringing Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika into contemporary philosophical discourse. I, like any translator-interpreter, must acknowledge that there is simply no fact of the matter about the correct rendering of any important and genuinely interesting text. Interpretations, and with them translations, will continue to evolve as our understanding of the text evolves and as our interpretive horizon changes. Matters are even more complex and indeterminate when the translation crosses centuries, traditions, and languages, and sets of philosophical assumptions that are quite distant from one another, as is the case in the present project. So each of the available versions of the text embodies a reading. Inada reads Nagarjuna from the standpoint of the Zen tradition, and his translation reflects that reading. Kalu Pahana reads Nagarjuna as a Theravada commentator on the Kakayanagota Sutra, and his translation reflects that reading, as well as his view about the affinities between James's pragmatism and Theravada Buddhism. Sprung adopts Murti Kantian's interpretation of Madhyamika, and his translation reflects, is it Madhyamika Kakarika? Am I reading the vowel wrong? No, Madhyamaka, okay. Madhyamaka, middle way, right? Madhyamika sometimes. I don't know the difference, but we'll just keep reading. His translation reflects that interpretation. Strang reads the text as primarily concerned with religious phenomenology. There is no translation of this text into English and no commentary on it that specifically reflects an Indo-Tibetan Prasangika Madhyamika interpretation, inasmuch as this is my own preferred way to read Nagarjuna, and the reading dominant in Tibetan and highly influential in Japanese and Chinese discussions of Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika, I believe that is important to fill this lacuna in the English bibliography. Okay, that's interesting. And as you might surmise based on, you know, my shawl and the statues behind me, I too have an affinity for the Indo-Tibetan. And of course, we've got the Japanese on either side. So perhaps I am, in the same tribe as Garfield, although I am sort of a hermit, so I don't think of myself as a tribe type person, but egregore, you might say. I wouldn't, but you might. So we're looking wherever Garfield's coming from, through that lens, and then through the lens of Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism, looking back in time from their perspective at that time period in 150 Nagarjuna. So we're going to try to ride that beam of light from YouTube by way of my voice, by way of Garfield's pen and translation, by way of an Indo-Tibetan perspective, and ride the light all the way to arrive at Nagarjuna himself in 150 Common Era and see if we can connect with him. I think we can do it. I have faith in us. Okay, having argued that the introduction's almost over, just another page, and then we can get to it. Having argued that all translation involves some interpretation, and hence that there is always some distance between an original text and a translation, however good and canonical that translation may be, it follows that Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika and Dubu Ma Urtsa Ba Shes Rab differ. Okay, that must be the same thing in Tibetan. However close they may be, I don't know, and however canonically the latter is treated. Since Dubu Ma Urtsa Ba Shes Rab is the text read by and commentary on by generations of Tibetan philosophers. Okay, I think that it is important that an English translation of this very text be available to the Western philosophical public. This text is hence worthy in its own right of translation inasmuch as it is the proper subject of the Tibetan philosophical literature I and others find so deep and fascinating. This is not a critical scholarly edition of the text. It is not philosophical in intent, nor is it a discussion of the commentarial literature on Nagarjuna's text. There is indeed a need for such a book, but that will have to be filled by someone else. This is rather meant to be a presentation of a philosophical text to philosophers, and not an edition of the text for Buddhologists. All right. If philosophers and students who read my book thereby gain an entrance into Nagarjuna's philosophy and see Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika as interpreted herein as a text worthy of study and discussion, this work will have served its purpose. Since my intended audience is not Buddhologists per se, I honestly have no idea what a Buddhologist is. I mean, ology, study of Buddha, study of Buddhism, is different from philosophers and philosophy, and Nagarjuna's a philosopher for philosophers. From his, I honestly don't get the distinction, but oh well, I don't know. Anyway, per se, but Western philosophers who are interested in Buddhist philosophy. He's writing this for Western philosophers who are interested in Buddhist philosophy. Okay, well, we all have our flaws. I have tried to balance standard renderings of Buddhist terminology with the more perspicuous contemporary philosophical language. I am not sure that I have always made the right decisions or that I have found the middle path between the extremes of Buddhological orthodoxy. Ah, okay, well, the word orthodoxy kind of gives me a clue. Buddhological orthodoxy, yeah, okay. All right, let's steer clear of that. I agree. And Western revisionism. Is that the let's bring up the spectrum. This is a spectrum that I use on another program. So we've got Buddhological orthodoxy on one hand and Western revisionism on the other. I would say that rather than aiming for the middle of this spectrum, I would say let us say that this spectrum is a false dichotomy, disregard it, and acknowledge that while he may think that he's operating on that spectrum, let's not, okay? We're neither Western revisionists nor Buddhological orthodoxists, right? Are you with me? You don't have to be with me. You can just observe the weird animal on the other side of the screen, and I will continue. Just do my thing. I am also striving for that elusive middle path between two other extremes in tradition. I am trying, on one hand, to avoid the unreadable literalism of translations that strive to provide a verbatim report of the words used in the original, regardless of whether that results in a comprehensible English text. But there is, on the other hand, the extreme represented by a translation written in lucid English prose purporting to be what the original author would have written had he been a 20th century philosopher writing in English, or one that, in an attempt to convey what the text really means on some particular interpretation, is in fact not a translation of the original text, but a completely new book, bearing only a distant relation to the original. Okay. This hopelessly mixes the tasks of translation on the one hand and critical commentary on the other. Of course, as I have noted above, these tasks are intertwined, but there is the fault of allowing the translation to become so mixed with commentary that one no longer has a grip on, for example, what is Nagarjuna and what is Garfield? After all, although the text is interpreted and being translated, this text should still come out in translation as a text which could be interpreted in the ways that others have read it, because the original does indeed justify competing interpretations. That is one of the things that makes it such an important philosophical work. J. L. Garfield, Amherst, Massachusetts, November 1994. Okay, I feel like I've gotten to know the translator and commentator a little bit, and I feel like I've developed a little bit of a trust for him, you know. So I think we're in good hands here. So without further ado, I'm not going to read the acknowledgments. People helped him write it. Good enough. Not going to read the table of contents. Going to get right into it. Part 1. Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika. Dedicatory verses. I prostrate to the perfect Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever is dependently arisen is unceasing, unborn, unannihilated, not permanent, not coming, not going, without distinction, without identity, and free from conceptual construction. Okay. Chapter 1. Examination of Conditions. 1. Neither from itself, nor from another, nor from both, nor without a cause, does anything, whatever, anywhere, arise. Not that. 2. There are 4 conditions. Efficient condition. Percept object condition. Can we put some kind of definition above my head? Whatever you can get from Google. Immediate condition for percept object. Immediate condition. Dominant condition. Just so. There is no 5th condition. Okay. Efficient, percept object, immediate, and dominant. Perhaps he'll explain these later. 3. The essence of entities is not present in the conditions, etc. 4 dots. Did Nagarjuna write etc. with 4 dots, or did he write some stuff that got left out? I'm raising an eyebrow at you, Garfield. No. If there is no essence, there can be no otherness essence. Okay. 4. Power to act does not have conditions. There is no power to act without conditions. There are no conditions without power to act. Nor do any have the power to act. All right, I'll keep reading. 5. These give rise to those. So these are called conditions. As long as those do not come from these, why are these not non-conditions? All right. 6. For neither an existent nor a non-existent thing is a condition appropriate. If a thing is non-existent, how could it have a condition? If a thing is already existent, what would a condition do? 7. When neither existence, with a TS, not a C, nor non-existence with a TS, nor existent non-existence. Existence and existence sound far too similar. I'm going to have to clarify, because existence, if I say existence, you can assume I mean with a CE. If I see existent, then I kind of have to clarify, otherwise you'll assume I mean existence. And existence and existent, plural for existent, I mean, clearly, sort of clearly, are distinct from one another, right? Existence is like all the state of... Never mind. I'll just keep reading. Okay. Non-existence, TS, or existent non-existence, TS, are established. How could one propose a productive cause? If there were one, it would be pointless. Right. 8. An existent entity, parentheses mental mode, or mental episode, an existent entity, parentheses mental episode, and parentheses, has no object. Since a mental episode is without an object, how could there be any percept condition? 9. Since things are not arisen, cessation is not acceptable. Therefore, an immediate condition is not reasonable. If something has ceased, how could it be a condition? 10. If things did not exist without essence, the phrase, when this exists, so this will be, would not be acceptable. 11. In the several or united conditions, the effect cannot be found. How could something not in the conditions come from the conditions? 12. However, if a non-existent effect arises from these conditions, why does it not arise from non-conditions? 13. If the effect's existence is the conditions, if the effect's essence is the conditions, but the conditions don't have their own essence, how could an effect whose essence is the conditions come from something that is essenceless? 14. Therefore, neither with conditions as their essence, nor with non-conditions as their essence, are there any effects. If there are no such effects, how could conditions or non-conditions be evident? Let me pause before I read chapter 2. If indeed we read chapter 2 in this episode. All right. I just kind of want to unpack. I hope you don't mind. This isn't just like a free audiobook service. This is a process. And again, I'm not a teacher. I am a person going through this process by way of this video series in order to share the process out loud. So sometimes I have to stop and think out loud. Wow. I feel like we've made two friends today. One is Garfield and one is Nagarjuna. I already feel like I know them both a little bit, just from this brief encounter through words. It's very interesting to me, the different things that we're currently reading. Let's kind of put the books up somewhere on the screen. So we've got the Vinaya Pitaka from the Pali scriptures, which is very down to earth. And it kind of takes you in a time machine back to ancient 6th century before Common Era, Bihar, India. And you really feel like you're dwelling with these ancient monks. And so far, I mean, again, we've only read the Vinaya Pitaka so far. So it is very down to earth. It's rules. It's practical things. It's how do we have a meeting? How do we enforce rules? How do we determine, you know, what the punishment should be for different crimes in the order. So that's one thing. And then we have the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, which is very different, which is either something that was inspired or channeled by somebody a few hundred years ago as, you know, or as he purports, it was discovered and it was written in the 8th century or 9th or whatever, you know, when Yeshi Togyal wrote it or dictated it, and somehow it got written down and then lost and then rediscovered, or it was written later. Either way, it's very interesting, it's poetic, it's bizarre, it's surreal, it's astral, it's all over the place. It's intensely like alchemical, symbolic, sometimes very disturbing and violent and nightmarish and yet inspiring somehow. And it takes you on this sort of like Ghibli-esque psychedelic journey. It's very different from the Vinaya Pitaka. And then we're also reading the Shobogenzo of Ehe Dogen. And while Zen has a sort of reputation, like the koan. Sometimes, you know, a thing doesn't make sense, and the point is that it doesn't make sense, and it's to kind of jar you out of sense itself into a satori, you know? but Dogen is giving lectures to his monks, and he's helping them understand. So he's holding their hand, and so in a way he's holding ours, and guiding them and us through a deeper connection with these concepts. And sometimes it's practical. He's teaching you literally how to wipe your behind after you go potty in the monastery, not in the monastery, but just outside. Yeah, or, you know, in the that wing. Or, you know, introducing you to concepts like existence in present time is the only existence there is. And past, present, and future are all here now. And we're never anywhere else. Yeah, things like that. I'm putting it in my own words. If you want to hear that one, existence time is really good. That's Zen Buddhism 18. That was the previous episode of Buddhist Books Podcast. But, it, you know, things like that. So the experience of reading Tipitaka, the experience of reading Padmasambhava, the experience of reading Shobogenzo, we're also reading the Platform Sutra, but I'm going to set that aside for just this example that I'm giving right now. Three very different things, and this is a fourth new thing that is very different from any of those three. Part of me wants to say that this exhibits the fallacy of...
Gish Gallop. The debater makes point after dubious point, and if the other debater doesn't rebut every single one, they will appear to have lost the argument.
I'm hoping that I was able to find that. No. No, and it's not exactly right. But in the context of, I mean, please bear with me while I'm processing through these thoughts. I'm not just coming out and saying, oh, this is illogical. No. But in the context of that this was the result of, assuming that that summary from that cartoon AI-generated Buddhist wisdom YouTube channel is correct, because that's kind of where I kind of got, oh, okay, this is like... really making me interested in reading Mula Madhyamaka Kakarika. That was this, if you want to watch that. It's like 30 minutes long. I honestly only saw the first 6 minutes, and then I was like, okay, I'm going to stop watching this and add this to Buddhist Books Podcast. So it had an effect on me, but I didn't want to like watch the rest of the half an hour of AI-generated speech and, you know, interesting visual effects. What am I talking about? So as is put in the probably false dichotomy of, you know, today, from a today perspective, they say, oh, it was the Hindu scholars, the Hindu philosophers versus the Buddhist philosophers. But I don't know if they would have referred to themselves that way at the time. That's kind of a today way of, you know, simplifying. They put religions in little bubbles and put little labels on them and then try to understand events that went on in the past based on our present day understandings. Like, I could give other examples of that, but I won't go off on a tangent. So according to the story, they were asking all kinds of questions. Well, where do you stand on this? Where do you stand on that? What is this? What is that? And some of the Buddhist schools were saying, well, it's this, it's that, and trying to give a concrete answer. Buddha would have said it's this. Buddha would have said it's that. And Nagarjuna is coming along and saying, the causes without the conditions and the conditions without the causes. I mean, I don't mean to mock, but just the experience I just had reading those two pages was very like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm sorry. I guess I'm not deep enough, I'm not intelligent enough to read that and follow what he's saying. Maybe I will. Maybe it just requires a deeper study. And maybe I'm silly for insisting upon not seeking out a teacher to explain it to me. But I have my reasons for not doing that. But yeah, it does kind of come across as something that cannot be argued with, because how could you possibly argue with something that sounds like that? That was like, what did he just say? I guess he won the argument. Okay, this is so deep and profound that I don't even understand what you're saying. Okay, the king says you can continue with this, what do you call it, Buddhism, and build your Nalanda University. Nalanda was built after this, right? After the, or was it 150 CE? I think it was built after that. Anyway, all right, so those are my thoughts. I'm going to go ahead and close here. I hope that nobody's too disappointed. I'm fascinated. I look forward to part two of this series. So every 10 episodes of Buddhist Books Podcast, we will read at least one chapter, if the chapters are as short as that. And sometimes they get longer, then we'll only read one. But we'll definitely read more than we did today for part two. Part one, I wanted to kind of introduce the idea and kind of like put my foot in the water and, you know, say, okay, all right, this is what we're getting ourselves into. All right, I'll read a little bit more. I don't want to read an incomplete... Okay, yeah, the chapters are short, so I'll read chapter two, and then we'll close for today, and then see how chapter two is. See if it's similar to chapter one or completely different. Chapter two, examination of motion. One, what has been moved is not moving. Okay. I can a little bit wrap my mind around that. But also kind of go, what? Is it a metaphor? Like if we're thinking non-metaphorically and we're thinking in modern times, what has been moved is not moving. So the, you know what I mean? Like if something's in motion, something put it in motion. It got in motion somehow, but it's not moving. If it were to change direction, if it were to stop, then that would be it moving. Maybe. That's one level. If something caused it to move, it itself is not the one that is moving. I mean, kind of. For practical purposes, you'd say, oh yeah, that's moving. But he's getting deeper with it and saying, is it moving or has it been moved? Oh. All right. Sorry, that was just one line. We're never going to get through this chapter if I stop and... Okay, apart from what has been moved and what has not been moved, movement cannot be conceived. All right. I feel like this is a little bit easier to grasp than most of chapter one. Two, where there is change, there is motion. Since there is change in the moving and not in the moved or not moved, motion is in that which is moving. Three, how would it be acceptable for motion to be in the mover? I mean, if you're on a train and you throw a ball, never mind, I'll just... When it is not moving, it is not acceptable to call it a mover. Okay. Three, how would it be acceptable for motion to be in the mover? When it is not moving, it is not acceptable to call it a mover. I will say that so far everything that we've read does not remind me of anything that we've read in the Tipitaka. So that's interesting. But again, when we get into the second basket, then perhaps a few things will go, this is what Nagarjuna was talking about. So we'll see. This is going a little bit out of order. Just a little bit. All right. Like Pulp Fiction, you hear the second half of the story before you finish the first half of the story, and then in the end you go, oh, that's why they're wearing those clothes at the diner, right? Never mind. Three, how would it be acceptable for motion to be in the mover? When it is not moving, it is not acceptable to call it a mover. I think we read that twice. That was the second time I read that. I'll keep reading. Four, for whomever there is motion in the mover, there could be non-motion evident in the mover. But having motion follows from being a mover. Okay. 5. If motion is in the mover, there would have to be a twofold motion, one in virtue of which it is a mover, and one in virtue of which it moves. Sidebar. I think that it's lovely to have the benefit of not being in a philosophical debate with philosophers coming from different schools, identifying their egos with the collective ego of the school, and or trying to solicit funding from a king. It's a beautiful thing to not be in that situation, because I believe that a person can attain enlightenment and liberation in meditation without ever once examining anything close to these ideas. That's just my editorial commentary there, for whatever it's worth. 6. If there were a twofold motion, the subject of that motion would be twofold. For without a subject of motion, there cannot be motion. There was a guy that was teaching us how to play the flute down in Mysuru, Mysore, in Karnataka, India. And he was Hindu, and he was making reference to those debates and laughing, saying, yeah, when the Buddhists came up and the Hindus said, well, if you say there's no self, then who is this standing before me? If there's nobody here, then I guess I win the debate. And I was sitting there like, what the fuck? Why? Gotta make it a bit like a football team. Like, my football team is obviously better than that football team. I'm not saying Hindus are like this. I'm saying there was this one example of this guy who was acting like this. I think it's absurd to laugh like a bully in reference to a story about debates that went on. That turned out it was just the prologue to a story of, and then came Nagarjuna. And he shut everyone up. You know, the guy who taught me how to play the flute didn't mention Nagarjuna. He just mentioned the guy before Nagarjuna came along that lost the argument, right? And laughed in not a friendly way. I didn't identify myself as Buddhist at the time. I was just learning the flute and quietly condemning him for his assholishness. If you'll pardon my Francais. Anyway. Speaking of egos, identifying with group egos and philosophical, at least we're not trying to solicit funding from a king, right? Right, okay. What? I don't know. Sometimes I read things that cause things to come out of me, and sometimes they're directly related to the text, sometimes not. And then I record it, and then I hear myself say it, and then think about it, and then I can reflect on it. And then if it's useful to you, great. If it's not, sorry to waste your time. I don't know. Let's see. You're always free to click away whenever you wish. Subscribe, unsubscribe, thumbs up, thumbs down. It's all up to you, baby. I don't mean baby. Like, it's just an expression. Imitating Ryan George, really. He likes to throw a baby in every now and then. Not throw a baby, like Philemon in day before yesterday's Carl Jung reading of Chicken Philosophy. That's Sister Channel. Read a few different things. Okay, let's try to finish this chapter 2. Is it long? Am I ever going to finish it? My God. Okay, what have I gotten myself into? It's weird because sometimes I don't know whether I read this until I'm finished reading it. I mean, each section. So 6, if there were a twofold motion, the subject of that motion would be twofold. For without a subject of motion, there cannot be motion. Okay, something has to be moving in order for movement to exist. Sure, if you're talking about literal physical objects and not metaphorically using these words. 7. if without a mover, it would not be correct to say that there is motion. Then, if there were no motion, how could there be a mover? Is the point that there doesn't have to be a mover? Because if so, I agree. 8. Inasmuch as a real mover does not move, and a non-mover does not move, apart from a mover and a non-mover, what third thing could move? That's an interest. That's more Koan-y, Koan-ish. You could sit and think about that. What else besides a mover and a non-mover could move? 9. When without motion, it is unacceptable to call something a mover, how will it be acceptable to say that a mover moves? Okay. 10. For him whose perspective... What? For him from whose perspective a mover moves, there would be the consequence that without motion there could be a mover because a mover moves. My great aunt was, very young. Between 5 and 8. I don't know how young exactly, but she was very young. My grandpa was 14 when, with their mother, they left New York and their father and sailed through the Panama Canal and arrived in California, relocated there. But my great aunt remembers her father leaving on a boat, but it was just a trick of perspective. She was on the boat, and she remembers seeing her father get further and further away and the water, but it was a dock. Father was on the dock. He didn't leave on the boat. They left on the boat. So, I mean, that's what's coming to mind here. From when the perspective of a person, something moves. I don't know if that's where he's going with this, but then just thought I'd blurt that out, because why not? Right. From him whose perspective a mover moves, there would be the consequence that without motion, there could be a mover, because a mover moves. Not exactly the same as my great-grandpa on the dock, but I don't know what it is, honestly. But 11. If a mover were to move, there would be a twofold motion, one in virtue of which he is a mover, and one in virtue of which the mover moves. Okay. 12. Motion does not begin in what has moved, nor does it begin in what has not moved, nor does it begin in what is moving. In what, then, does motion begin? The Big Bang? No. Primum mobile? Reshit ha-Gilgalim? 13. Prior to the beginning of motion, there is no beginning of motion in the going or in the gone. How could there be motion in the not gone? I'm going to go with moo. I know that's not really a thing yet in Buddhism, but my understanding is that that's Japanese Zen for it's a stupid question. I mean, it doesn't make sense. My dad would just say, non sequitur, what's the difference between a mouse? You know, sorry, no, I'm, with all due respect, no, I'll just keep reading. Sorry. 14, how could there... What does this have to do? Let me read it again, and maybe you can understand my frustration. Prior to the beginning of motion, there is no beginning of motion in the going or in the gone. How could there be motion in the not gone? Well, let's see. My finger is not gone. Oh, look, it's moving. What does that have to do with before the beginning there was no beginning? What? I mean, again, if you're a Zen koan artist trying to break someone's brain so that they'll become enlightened, I respect it. If you're a Buddhist apologist in second century India trying to procure funding from the king by confusing him to death, I respect it. There is no third reason for that to have been written down. That's what I'd say. I'm going to write that down. I'll just keep reading. 14. Since the beginning of motion cannot be conceived in any way, what gone thing, what going thing, and what non-going thing can be posited? I'd like to take this moment to give a little shout out to another one of my YouTube channels. It's called Going Gone. Just seems like they're talking about going and gone so much that I just thought I'd see what happened was, I'm talking to you from Goa right now. It's where I've gone, and I am gone from where I was before. So, Piyu, my wife, was from somewhere else. She was from Bihar, actually, where Lord Buddha, and possibly where Mula Madhyamaka was written. And she's gone from there, of course. I'm gone from California. We're in Goa. Going, gone. Check it out. It's fun. It's just a little day in the life videos of our life here in Goa. All right. Fifteen. Just as a moving thing is not stationary, a non-moving thing is not stationary. Apart from the moving and the non-moving, a non-moving thing is not stationary? Isn't that the definition of stationary, aside from paper and pencils and stuff? But like stationary means not moving. A non-moving thing is not stationary? Nagarjuna, what are you talking about? Sorry. Apart from the moving and the non-moving, what third thing is stationary? It's a good formula, poetic formula or whatever. This and this, what third thing? It's good. Yeah. Break out of dichotomies. Good way to confuse the opposition into letting you exist and build a university and Rajgir. 16. If without motion, it is not appropriate to posit a mover, how could it be appropriate to say that a moving thing is stationary? I mean, again, if you're on a train and you put your orange, why is it an orange, on your tray, then relative to the tray, the orange is stationary. If you're on planet Earth, sitting in deep meditation, relative to the Earth, you are stationary, but not relative to anything else other than the Earth. Because the Earth is in motion. I don't know. Never mind. I'll just keep reading. If one does not halt from moving, what did I again? What moving thing is stationary? Okay. 17. One does not halt from moving, nor from having moved, or not having moved. Motion and coming to rest, and starting to move are similar. Well, that one wasn't infuriating and does not make me want to tear my hair out. Thank you, Nagarjuna. It's nice to have a little break from that feeling. 18. That motion just is the mover itself is not correct. Okay. Nor is it correct that they are completely different. Ah, not two, not one. Non-dual. Okay. 19. It would follow from the identity of the mover and motion that agent and action are identical. And the dancer becomes the dance. Flash dance lyrics. 20. It would follow from a real distinction between motion and mover. Or no, maniac. She's a maniac. From the movie Flashdance. Never mind. I'm old. It would follow from a real distinction between motion and mover that there could be a mover without motion and motion without a mover. Okay. Which there can't, right? This is kind of what you're getting at. If these weren't the same, or if these weren't in some essence similar or overlapping or of the same then you could have movement without a mover and a mover without movement. 21. When neither in identity nor in difference, in space difference, can they be established, how can these two be established at all? Good, good. The person walking implies the ground beneath him and the world behind him or her, all right? These two things kind of go together, macrocosm and microcosm. Would there be either without the other? 22. The motion by means of which a mover is manifest cannot be the motion by means of which he moves. He does not exist before that motion. So what and where is the thing that moves? 23. A mover does not carry out a different motion from that by means of which he is manifest as a mover. Moreover, in one mover, a twofold motion is unacceptable. You can pat your head and rub your belly at the same time. 24. A really existent mover doesn't move in any of the three ways. A non-existent mover doesn't move in any of the three ways. I don't get it, but I like it. 25. Neither an entity nor a non-entity moves in any of the three ways. So motion, mover, and root or route are non-existent. Mind-blowing but nonsensical. But I'm sure there are millions who would disagree with me and say, no, 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 it makes sense, you just don't get it. And that's okay. It's okay. All right. I like it. I dig it. It's definitely not reminiscent of anything else that we have read on Buddhist Books Podcast. And I have a feeling that there will be other things. You know, he's going over some basic things, because that was kind of some of the things that were apparently being debated between various schools back in 150. Was like, well, what is the nature of motion? What is the nature of particles? What is the nature of the physical world? What is the foundation for existence? And so then they all had to chime in with their different ideas. And Nagarjuna is coming in. Oh, it's not this and not this. How could it be this if it's not that? And if it's not that, then it's this. And if it's that, if it's non-this, then it's non-that. And it's non-that. Therefore, none of it. Moo. Proto-moo. Proto-moo-moo. Okay. I mean, it would have been a different kind of moo, because there are a lot of cows in India, right? I enjoyed this, and I look forward to reading more of it, and I'm also grateful that it's only one out of every 10 episodes, because I like reading about monks getting caught masturbating and having to decide to shun each other and, you know, come to Jesus and apologize or whatever, you know, go 6 days probation and then come back and then get to eat with everybody else again. And that kind of thing. It's just kind of like, okay. So this really is earth we're talking about, right? You know, and then I also enjoy, you know, next time it's going to be, episode 320, which again, when there's a zero, is the life and liberation of Padmasambhava. So next time we're going to get into the psychedelic nightmare poetry story of Padmasambhava and his various incarnations and consorts. I hate that word, but it's the word that they use, so I just have to adjust. Female students with whom he practices tantric forms of it's the life and liberation of Padmasambhava. So that'll be up next time. So tune in, subscribe, and thanks for being here. I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll go ahead and do our usual closing that we do here on Buddhist Books Podcast. To the north and to the south, to the east and to the west. To the spirits of light among us and to the spirits below, we send out our reverent love and compassion. May all beings be happy. May all beings be serene. May all beings be in peace. Until next time.